Hello, everybody. Please allow myself to introduce myself. I am your host, Captain Marvelous, and this is the 28th episode of I'm Batman, the podcast, the show where I chronologically review each and every episode of the 1992 Batman the Animated Series. Let's get to it. This week's episode is titled Night of the Ninja. Original air date, October 26, 1992. The title card is actually pretty awful. It's a really bad silhouette of a ninja with glowing eyes and a gold sword on a blue background. It really looks like this was something the artist had his kid do. It doesn't look good at all. We start off outside of a building with a sign that says Wayne Cosmetics. Inside, a man works on a computer when he is assaulted by a ninja who knocks him out using purple gas. The ninja is just what you picture when I say ninja, which is a man in a black costume and a black mask with a sword. The ninja breaks into a vault and he steals all the money. Then a security guard walks in, but the ninja literally just walks past him. I don't know if that takes much ninja skill, but he literally just like kind of sneaks by his back. The guard follows the ninja to the roof holding a gun, but he is disarmed when the ninja throws a ninja star and he pins the gun to the wall. He then uses his sword to cut the guard's flashlight in half. Then the ninja disappears. So we're at Wayne Manor, where Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson are practicing karate, and Bruce is just beating the crap out of Robin, because, of course, he is. So, yeah, we get whiny Dick Grayson, so he says, "Sorry, some of us aren't perfect." Yeah, you dumby, that's why Batman is teaching you, so you could be better at this, so stop whining. Alfred walks in, and he informs Bruce of another robbery at Wayne Enterprises. So Dick says, "That's the sixth robbery in 2 weeks!" And Bruce corrects him and says, "It's the seventh." Then Robin sticks his tongue out and pulls his cheeks to the side at Bruce Wayne, because Dick is still years old. I'm sorry, he's still 10 years old, it seems. So, I apologize for calling him Dick and then Robin or Bruce and then Batman, but I think that most of the audience listening to the show know that Batman is Bruce Wayne and that Dick Grayson is Robin. So, therefore, they're kind of interchangeable unless the episode doesn't call it to be. And this one, it doesn't matter if it's Bruce or Batman. Gordon is on the roof investigating the crime scene when Bruce Wayne shows up, and Commissioner Gordon points out the ninja star, and Bruce goes into a flashback. We get a sepia tone for the screen, and we are seeing a very young Bruce Wayne, and it's actually pretty cool. He's skinnier, he has the same hairstyle, but it's longer and a bit more floppish, and it's actually really cool to see a younger Batman. Bruce is facing off in a sparring match against an Asian student who we find out is named Kyodai Ken. Kyodai beats Bruce pretty easily, and then the sensei declares Kyodai the winner. Kyodai is really cocky and he tells Bruce that he's okay for a rich man's son. So then the sensei, who's like this old Mr. Miyagi type, runs like he's Quicksilver and he just tosses Kyodai across the room. Then the sensei says, "There's always somebody better. Now apologize." Damn, this old man just made Kyodai look like a punk. You know what? I guarantee you that this old man used to be a waiter, because Kyodai got served. Kyodai bows to Bruce and then leaves, removing his shirt. And Bruce notices Kyodai has a giant tattoo, like all across his back, of a samurai demon head. We go back to present day, where Bruce is snapped out of his flashback by Summer Gleason. She mentions that two buildings have been burned down, probably with the fire from that sick burn that the sensei gave to Kyodai. Right. And another building was blown up. And the computer system was wrecked in this latest crime. Commissioner Gordon seems angry that she knows so much, but she says she has sources. And Bruce doesn't say anything and just leaves. We cut to the Batcave, where Batman is heading out. He's walking toward the Batmobile, And Dick Grayson tells Batman to hold on. He's like, hold on, it's only going to take a minute for me to change into costume. But Batman tells Dick, nope, and he leaves without him. So, Batman is driving when he goes into another flashback. So we go back to the sepia tone, and Bruce Wayne is turning off candles with just the wind from his punches. Holy hell, that's so cool. So the sensei walks in, and he tells Bruce that he practices like a man obsessed. Bruce says that he lost today, and he has to be the best, no matter what it takes. The sensei tells Bruce that defeat can be more instructive than victory. Back at Wayne Tower, and the ninja is on the rooftop. A dark cloud covers the moon and casts a shadow, and then when the cloud moves and the shadow disappears, Batman is standing there. So, okay, yeah, that was pretty badass. And, you know, I think I'm going to try this out. I'm just going to dress all in black and just stand there for the moment when a shadow moves and then somebody sees me. So the ninja sees Batman and tells him that his beef isn't with him. He doesn't say beef, but he says that he has no quarrels with Batman. So if Batman leaves, he may live. Batman and the ninja have a fight, but the ninja shoots Batman with that purple gas he used to knock out the security guard. The gas leaves Batman on his knees, and the ninja raises his sword ready to decapitate Batman. At the last second, a birdarang knocks the sword from the ninja's hand, and it's Robin, who just saved Batman. And then Robin says this, which I admit is actually pretty funny.
Listen, dipstick, Batman's my pal. He can be a major jerk, but you gotta love him. And nobody tries to fillet him when I'm around.
The ninja runs away, but Robin tosses another birdarang. And yes, they're called bird-o-rangs because Robin is a bird, so it's not a batarang, it's a birdarang. Sounds dumb? That's the name of it. It cuts the ninja in the back, and the ninja's about to jump off the ledge of the building, but a still groggy Batman sees from the tear in the ninja costume that the ninja has a giant demon head tattooed that is the same tattoo that Kyodai Ken had. The ninja gets away, and Batman tells Robin to leave. There's nothing else to do. Then Robin does a Batman impression, which, once again, I admit, it's actually pretty funny.
You okay?
I'm fine. Come on. There's nothing more to do here.
Thanks for saving my bacon, Robin. Hey, no problemo, Batman.
In the Batmobile, Batman explains to Robin the difference between samurai and ninja. She says ninjas are spies and assassins, and their only code is to get the job done, as opposed to the honorable code of the samurai warrior. Batman says he knows this ninja, and his name is Kyodaigen. Batman says he was good, but he won't tell Robin anything else. So now we are with Summer Gleason, and she is investigating this ninja story. She says she's going to drop by at Wayne's charity ball later on tonight. So we're at Wayne Manor now, and we get an interesting scene. Alfred talks to Robin, and Robin asks about Kyodai Ken. Alfred says he knew him from traveling with Bruce to Japan. Now, I say this is interesting because in most interpretations of Batman, Batman, or Bruce Wayne, rather, does his training alone. He travels the world by himself and doesn't have Alfred with him. And I say most iterations, so don't email me saying, no, but in this issue, blah, blah, blah. So it's really, I find it kind of odd that Alfred was traveling with him to Japan, so. Alfred tells Dick that Kyodai Ken was the only student who could consistently beat Bruce in a fight. So Robin is worried that Bruce feels he can't take on Kyodai. And Alfred says Dick should know by now that Bruce will never admit fear. Both men almost have a heart attack as they notice that Bruce Wayne has been standing there the whole time listening. Bruce says that he's leaving, and then he leaves. We're at some museum charity ball, and Bruce is looking at a ninja sword, and he goes into another flashback. So back to the sepia tone, and we see a person break into the dojo and try to steal a sword. The lights turn on, and the thief is Kyodai Ken, so he's caught by Bruce Wayne. Kyodai Ken wants to steal the sword to sell it, because it's a sword that's over 500 years old. Bruce and Kyodai are about to fight when the sensei walks in and he tells them to stop. Sensei tells Kyodai that he is banned from the dojo and he tells him to leave. Kyodai promises to get revenge against Bruce and he leaves. Everyone's just leaving. Now Bruce is ready to leave the museum, but he is being followed by Summer Gleason. and she's asking him questions about the robberies. She follows Bruce into his car. She gets in the passenger side, but the valet parking guy interrupts them. And the valet parking guy takes off his hat, and it's Kyo Daiken, and he uses his purple gas to knock both of them out. Back in the Batcave, and Robin tracks Bruce's car because Bruce has not arrived yet. So I like this. I like the way they're using Robin. He's not just a dummy. Like, he's actually doing stuff here. Robin tracks down Bruce to a warehouse that has, like, these giant rolls of fabric or carpet inside. And Kyodai has Bruce and Summer Gleason tied up. And then we get this exchange.
Ah, the rich man awakens. Remember me?
I remember you, Kyodai.
Well, you should recall the man you ruined. I was forced to become a thief after I was cast out of the dojo.
As I remember it, being a thief was what got you thrown out in the first place.
You know, I think I figured out what Kyodai Ken means in Japanese. It must mean barbecue, because he just got burned! Summer Gleason wakes up, and hears Kyodai say that he stole Bruce Wayne's bank codes and will soon transfer all of Bruce's money into his own accounts. And I'm not sure what the plan is there, but yeah, let's go with it. Summer points out that Kyodai is nothing but a common thief. So Kyodai draws his sword and is about to kill Bruce and Summer, but an alarm is tripped by Robin because, well, let's face it, he's Robin and he's kind of dumb. So of course he's going to trip an alarm. Ironically though, tripping the alarm is what saved Bruce and Summer's life. Look at that. Ironically, used correctly. Who would have thought? Robin climbs to the roof, and he is confronted by Kyodai. Kyodai handily defeats Robin by cutting the leg off a water tower on the roof and having the water wash Robin away off the roof, like, fall to his death, it seems. But Robin managed to hang onto a window, and he sneaks inside the building without Kyodai noticing. Inside, Bruce Wayne knocks over a statue, and he uses the statue's sword to cut himself loose, but he is found by Kyodai. Kyodai challenges Bruce to a one-on-one fight, no weapons. Bruce is about to go at it, but he notices that Summer is looking at him. So, Kyodai just beats the crap out of Bruce Wayne for a while. Robin shows up, and using a slingshot, he throws like a ball bearing to a hook above Summer, causing this giant roll of carpet or fabric to unfurl on top of her and block her view. So, I'm actually more interested in why is Robin using a slingshot? And I don't mean like he's using a slingshot like Dennis the Menace slingshot, like Bart Simpson. No, he's using like David and Goliath, I'm going to swing this thing, this leather strap over my head slingshot. And he manages to hit this tiny hook. That's all right. I'll give him props. That's pretty good skill right there. So now that Summer can't see Bruce, he gets serious. And he proceeds to kick Kyodai's butt. Kyodai gets scared and he throws a statue at a window and he runs away, diving out of the building into a river below. So after this, we cut to Wayne Manor, where Dick and Bruce are having breakfast. Bruce says that he told Summer Gleason that Batman arrived and he took care of Kyodai. But Kyodai is still on the loose. Bruce thanks Robin for his help, and Robin smiles like a goofball. The end. Wait, what? Wait, the end. That's actually it. I thought there would... It seems like there's a whole chunk of story missing here. Let's get to some after show notes. I think seeing Bruce Wayne as a young man is super cool. Especially because this is the first time that the animated series has shown any type of Bruce Wayne in training. So I think I like the whole sequence there. Dong Yang Animation, they did a decent job on this episode. The animation is actually really good. I really like the flashback parts as well. And Robin is actually pretty good in this episode. He's not as annoying. He actually proves his worth to being a sidekick. So I like all those things.
Batman.
But Batman, you say? I like this episode. But I feel it's missing a lot. And I especially feel it's missing an ending. Kyodai Ken just got away. He still has like all of Bruce's bank codes. And just because he left his sword in the carpet place doesn't mean he can't get any more weapons and still be terrorizing the Wayne Industries. But everyone just kind of acts like nothing happened, like, this is it. So, okay. I guess they just assume he went back to Japan. I don't know. It's really odd. It's missing an ending. It's like, okay, I did a Saved by the Bell show for about 2 years where we reviewed each Saved by the Bell episode. And one of the problems we noticed is that every few episodes, they wouldn't have an ending. The episode would be about Slater trying to train for the big championship game, or Zach for the track meet or something. And we would never find out who won the meet. Did Slater win the wrestling championship? Did he win the football game? We don't know. And they never tell us. That's kind of how this feels. It's like, so wait, did he get away? Is he alive? Is he dead? What's going to happen? Nope. This just ended with Robin laughing like a goof, or smiling like a goof. Now, Kiyodai, I thought was interesting until they revealed that all he wanted was money. And, you know, it just so happened that Bruce was like a rich man he could steal from and get revenge on. So, I don't know. He that kind of killed the character for me. He became kind of really boring after that. And all in all, it's a decent episode, but it just feels like it should be a two-parter, or like there was more to this, or like they were running on a short schedule and somebody just had an outline and they said, yeah, just go with it. It just seems like it's missing something of a story.
To the Batmobile. Let's go. Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
All right, now having said all that, where would we rank this in the Batcave Archives? The Batcave Archives is the segment of the show where we rank each episode that we are reviewing. As of now, we have 28 episodes. So where would this one rank? As I said, I feel it's missing something. It's not a bad episode. I liked it. I was really intrigued by it, but I just felt that it was missing something. I don't know. I'm sorry for all the dead air here. It's just I'm trying to think where we could put this. Because at number one, we have Heart of Ice, the Mr. Freeze origin. This is obviously not even in the top 10. At number 27, we have Prophecy of Doom, which is a really bad episode. Underdwellers was another bad episode. I don't think this is as bad as any of those. I don't think this episode is as bad as the kids rescuing Batman in their basement. But it's just that it's missing something. I'm looking to put it around maybe in the 20s. We have the episode The Last Laugh, which is the one with Joker and Captain Clown and the sea barge that's spreading the laughing gas across the city. I think this episode is a bit better than that. I'm going to put it at number 20, right, sandwiched in between The Clock King and The Cat in the Claw Part 2. Because The Cat in the Claw Part 2, I thought, was a pretty weak ending to a great first part. And The Clock King, he's a dumb character and whatnot, but his origin was interesting, and it told a full story. So our new... Yeah, we're going to put this on here. So at number 20, I will have The Night of the Ninja. Remember, if you want to view the full list, go to our Facebook page and join the group. You can see the entire list there, what we go week after week. You can put your thoughts in it. Let me know if maybe you think I'm ranking it too high, too low. I'd like to know what you think about that. So go to Facebook and look for I'm Batman the Podcast. Join the group and view the full list at your leisure. All right, well, before we end the show, I want to give you some thoughts. I want to go see the Suicide Squad movie this weekend, and I really liked it. So I'm going to just list off some of the thoughts I had, and do not worry, it is spoiler-free. So if you have not seen the movie yet, you could listen to this. I'm not going to spoil anything, and if I think I might, I will point it out. So let's get the negatives out of the way first. You've heard that you've maybe read the reviews. You maybe heard people talk on YouTube. They seem to hate this movie. I don't know why. I, at this point, don't know what critics want in a movie. I think all they want is for it to be a 20-minute commercial for the next Spider-Man movie, because that seems to get all the high star ratings. hey, let's make a really boring movie with an awesome fight in the middle. But then you could see, like, oh, so that's what Black Panther movie's going to look like. That's what Spider-Man movie's going to look like. Hey, let's do stories where absolutely nothing matters. Oh, man, look, that agent from S.H.I.E.L.D. died in Avengers. Oh, now he's alive and he's got his own TV show. Oh, man, I can't believe that this... Nope, he's still alive, but now he's this. So, you know, that's been my problem with Marvel movies for a while. Nothing matters. Everything just resets. I hear a lot of... But that's the status quo for most comic books. It shouldn't be the same for a movie. Change things up, you know? But anyways, I'm not going to go into that rant. I really like this movie. But I said, let's get negatives out of the way. I thought all the popular music that was added was very distracting, actually. At times, I felt it was out of place. There's a scene, and a minor spoiler here. There's a scene where they play an Eminem song. And it seems so out of place, and the music sounds louder than the audio, and it was very, very distracting to me. It's not the same for all of them, but I just think that they made a lot of weird choices with the music. Not the score, just like the pop songs they put in there, the popular songs, and sometimes it can be very distracting. Just like Batman vs. Superman, I found the editing very mixed, and sometimes it just took me out of the movie. Like, I noticed some very badly done jump cuts. But honestly, I think that's something you're going to notice, like, if you've taken an editing class. So, it's not... I don't think it's a big bother for most people. It's just something that I personally noticed. For example, there's scenes where you see somebody standing against the wall, but then they jump cut to them standing somewhere else, and it's kind of jarring. It doesn't affect the story in any way. It's just stuff, like I said, that caught my eye. I have a feeling that we're going to get some sort of Ultimate Edition Blu-ray DVD digital thing that's going to be longer with uncut scenes added to it that make the movie a lot better. I purchased the Batman vs. Superman Ultimate Edition with like 30 minutes of cutout footage. Those 30 minutes make a huge difference. It makes the plot way more coherent. It makes Lex Luthor look like less of a dumby. Because his plan actually somewhat makes sense. So I have a feeling they're going to do the same for this movie. And that's why I think we have a lot of weird edits and cuts in there. Now, the biggest problem in the movie for me was the use of the Joker. I liked his look. I liked his character. I liked the portrayal the actor did. It's all really cool. But we get so little of him. And honestly, he has no bearing on the main story. He's more of a... No, I'm not going to get into spoilers. It's just a very little screen time for the Joker. That's my biggest problem with the movie. Now here is what I liked about it. I liked all the characters in the squad. I think they were all fun. The movie is basically about Harley Quinn and Deadshot. And they are great. Will Smith, I don't know if you hate him. I find the guy very likable. He's Will Smith with guns. And he's awesome. He's funny. He's charismatic. You care about his character. Harley Quinn as well. You care about her. She's funny. She's colorful. She's wacky. She's dark. And I think these two main people really help move the movie along. The rest of the gang might be underdeveloped, but I'm fine with it. I'm fine with just having characters that just show up and they're there and they're who they are. I don't need 20 minutes extra in a movie about why some dude is a crocodile man and he's motivated by this and that. No, he's just, you know, he's just Killer Croc. Oh, he's a guy and he was born with this disease and he looks like a crocodile. Boop, thank you. You explained it to me. Now I can enjoy him. You didn't need to give me a 30-minute backstory about how his uncle was killed in a carjacking or some other crap. Oh, why is Captain Boomerang such an a-hole? I don't care. I like the fact that he's an a-hole. He's like a cowardly dude. And he's like... That's his character. He's a coward. He'll backstab you. But he's forced to be part of this gang against his own will. And that's the point of the story. And I like that. I don't care about his... Oh, well, he doesn't trust anybody because his parents got divorced when he was a kid. And let's show you a flashback of that. No, I don't care. So... I like the fact that they just let these characters be. Diablo and Amanda Waller are the standouts from the supporting characters in this movie. Amanda is just such a bitch that you just love to hate her. If you've watched the Justice League cartoon, then that's Amanda Waller in this movie. And she's awesome. She is really great. Diablo, I thought, this is a character I'm not familiar with. I haven't read Suicide Squad comics, so a lot of these characters I really don't know much about. I know about the main Batman villains, but you got characters like Diablo and other people there that I'm not really quite educated in their backgrounds and all that. So I thought Diablo had a great story to him. And the thing that I like the most about him, and it's a personal thing, is that he's just himself. He's a guy who has powers, he has his story, and that's it. Being Hispanic is not his character, so he's just a guy. I love that. I love the fact that he's just a guy. He's Hispanic, he speaks Spanish sometimes, and that's it. He's not like, oh, look at me, I'm Mexican, and I have a charro hat and maracas, and oh, hey, I'm going to talk like Dora the Explorer and say everything in English and then in Spanish, and hey, Holmes, essay, you know? He's just a guy who happens to be Hispanic. I love that. Now, the story is pretty generic. The villains are pretty generic, and the villains are probably the worst thing about this movie, Marvel, and, you know, that doesn't bother me. I like the fact that these villains are just who they are. They're just these threats that they need to stop, because the movie's about the team, not about the villains. They want to destroy the world, the team has to save it. It's that easy. So the team, you know, the fun of the movie is seeing the characters interact with each other. So I had no problem with the by-the-numbers, kill the villain, save the princess plot. What I loved about it is that the movie was just one entire mission, one night, to stop the bad guy, instead of a bunch of dumb, pointless scenes only because they want to film in different countries with no point to them. Once again, I'm looking at you, Marvel. So, this next point might be spoilerish. So, I'm going to describe the Joker's character and motivation. So, if you feel that's a spoiler, you could skip ahead. It's not going to take long. I love the take on Joker and Harley in this movie. They actually love each other. Joker isn't some jerk who just is in love with himself. He really, really wants her. Now, whether it's love, whether it's obsession, whether it's lust, who knows? But the point is that he wants her there with him, and he'll go to any lengths to get her back. And I love that. I love these two just being in love with each other instead of just a one-sided thing. Harley was created in, 1992? And we've had she loves him, he hates her relationship for, like, more than 20 years now. Change it up. I love it. I love Joker wanting something that's not just kill Batman. I think it really adds to the character. You know, the theme of this movie is love. I like that. Every character in this movie is motivated by something or someone they love, whether it's freedom, family, a lover, money, something. Love is what's making them do what they're doing. They're the bad guys, but even the bad guys have feelings. I like that. I think the theme of love is a good theme to have. So, you know, I think you should go out and see the movie. I really recommend it. It's worth your time. It's a fun movie. If you just hate it, then, you know what, I don't know what to tell you. Go watch Doctor Strange when it comes out and enjoy your little Marvel movies, whatever. But I think that it's worth giving it a shot. At the very least, just give it a shot. If you don't like it after you see it, then yeah, you formed your own opinion. That's cool. Don't just read the reviews and all of a sudden you just hate it or hate it because it's a DC movie. So, you know, that's all I can say. Go watch it. Now, lastly, I apologize for the show being uploaded so late, but the reason is that this weekend, Candy and I attended the Latino Comics Expo at the Museum of Latin American Arts in Long Beach. She was actually there to promote the first issue of Taco el Gato, which is out. Physical copies, people. She's got them. Sadly, we sold out. She sold out from all the issues that were sent to her. She's going to try to get more. Once those become available, I'll let you know how you can get your hands on them. As a matter of fact, I'm planning on holding a Taco El Gato giveaway. Let me figure out the details with her, what we're giving away, and I'll keep you updated on that. But yeah, we sold out of all the books, or she sold out. I'm not taking any credit for anything. She sold out of all her books. It was a really, really fun experience. Just because it was so busy. I've never been to anything that's been this busy. I've done art walks, I've done shows, but this was just like it was something else. There was so many people there, and everybody seemed interested in what you were selling instead of them walking around and looking at things like if they were in a swap meet trying to haggle with you for your artwork. You know, this is your artwork. You sell it at what you believe it's worth and not what somebody wants to pay you for it. So I really, really thought it was a fun thing. Now, my plan was to go around the show floor and interview some of these different artists at the expo. Now, we got so busy, I didn't really have time to do much. I have some interviews. I will post them so you can listen to those. It's about three or four of them. They're really, really fun people, really cool stuff. But, you know, I wanted to do more. Sadly, I couldn't. It's just because we were so busy. There wasn't really much time to do these from myself and from other people. You know, they're selling their wares, so they can't really just be sitting there talking to some jerk with a phone. So I'm going to let you listen to those now. Hello, everybody. I am Captain Marvelous, and I am here live at the Latino Comics Expo, celebrating its 5th year anniversary, located at the Museum of Latin American Arts in Long Beach. Here we have gathered quite a few independent comic book artists who are all here to make their name known, make their product known. So we will be interviewing a few of them, see what makes these people tick. So the first artists we have here are Javier and Isaac. They do quite a few awesome looking paintings I'm looking at here. I actually myself just purchased this awesome Kobe Bryant picture. So when you tell us about yourself, what motivates you to do what you do, and you know, what kind of techniques you use? Just, you know, general stuff about yourself.
Motivation-wise, I would say, I don't know, art's always been a thing I do as a kid.
Yeah.
I used to draw comic books, like, on my dad's butcher paper when I'd visit him at work and stuff.
That's awesome.
And so it just became a thing where I was stashing this art and I was thinking, like, maybe people will like it. So you put it out and you start getting a better response and you start making more stuff. And,
yeah.
Growing up, he would, because he's my nephew, he would watch me doing this stuff, and eventually he started drawing his own stuff too, and it became a family affair at that point.
Yeah. And I noticed you have a lot of things like superheroes and wrestling, especially the wrestling stuff. I'm a huge wrestling fan, so like, is it you only draw things that just like kind of speak to you, or have you tried like other things?
So wrestling's actually a big part of my childhood.
Yeah.
I always tell my friends, if you mix like Lucha Libre and like Ninja Turtles, like Batman stuff, you get me. Like, that's the equation to get Javier.
That's perfect.
That's pretty much what it is.
Yeah.
And I grew up on it. I was raised on it. My mom would let me watch it on TV. My sister used to watch Monday Night Raws with her as a kid. Go to the swap meets and buy all the lucha masks. My mom would talk to me about watching like Chavo Guerrero back in Ciudad Juarez, like in the 80s. And so you grow up with that. And I always tell people, like, luchadores are sort of like most kids, like their first superheroes.
Because
they exist in our world, you know what I mean? They exist on the same plane as us. They wear the mask and they do these superhuman feats of strength. And as a kid, you get enamored by it. And so now it's a lot about sort of showing my appreciation for a lot of that.
Yeah, all this work, all this stuff right here just looks really great. So, I mean, thank you for answering some of the questions here. And, you know, hope you have a good day today.
Thanks.
You can give some of your contact info where we can find some of your work so that the listeners that are interested can maybe look at your website and see some of the stuff.
Awesome. So you can visit me on the web at javsolo.com. That's JAVSOLO. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, under all that stuff. You usually see a bunch of Lucha Libre posts and stuff like that on there.
All right, this time we actually have something a bit different. We have the writer of some of the books. So why don't you introduce yourself and let us know about what you have here at the table.
What's up, Batman fans? My name is Johnny Parker. I'm the writer at Dito Comics. I write Blackfist and Brown Hand. I write Teen Horror, and I write Elvish. They're all awesome books. Check us out at DitoComics.com. And right here, I'm just at Teen Comics Expo, having a great time, promoting some of our books. And like I said, we have Blackfist and Brown Hand. It's a black and brown exploitation comedy, kind of like, you know, the Boondocks. It's like we make fun of stereotypes and hopes of bringing people together. Blackfist only talks in rhyme. Brown Hand only speaks Spanish. Blackfist's greatest weakness are spinning rims. Brown Hand's greatest weakness is a pickup truck and a job opportunity. It's hilarious. Our second issue is called Secret of the Horchata. Check it out. The Horchata Corporation is coming out with a new flavor of horchata. They think we'll bring the races together. It's called, of course, Grape Horchata. But the evil villain that issue is trying to stop it from coming out because I heard the sales of his crack burger. And then after that, it just gets hilarious and more fun. So look us up at NitoComics.com and check us out. It's a good breed.
Now, what's some of your inspirations from these books? Like, you mentioned this one, the Black Fist and Brown Hand. It's a lot of, like, the blaxploitation and the, like, those brown pride type films. But you also have here another book, Teen Horror and Elvish. One's fantasy, the other one's more horror, I guess. Obviously teen horror. So, you know, what are some of your inspirations for this? Because these are, like, pretty different genres to go from fantasy horror and like racial comedy.
Oh, well, honestly, the thing about this is that I love media and I love like intaking everything. But when it comes to teen horror, I love horror movies. Like, I love to see every horror movie comes out, good or bad. And trust me, there's some bad ones. But I love the whole aspect of horror and, like, you know, generating that emotion out of people. So when I wrote teen horror, I kind of looked at it as my opportunity to not just do horror, but do comedy and try to invoke, like, all emotions at the same time. Like, it's a really great horror story with these teenagers. Pretty much it begins with this, like, Catholic school. This teacher's leaving school in the middle of the night and she's walking to her car. She hears this kid crying in the corner. She goes to investigate, and the kid says he fell down and hit his head. She's like, okay, I'm gonna take you to the hospital. All the way to the hospital, he's just crying and crying and crying, but all of a sudden he just stops. And then he begins to sing this nursery rhyme over and over and over and over again as he makes his way up by the arm, and then he jacks the steering wheel and they crash. Cut to the next day, we meet our main character, Grace. Grace wants to be a famous YouTube star, so she's recording everything, including our best friend, Wyatt, who sells candy to kids, or as you like to say, slanging that diabetes. And the thing about it, as they're filming at school one day, they discover that their kids at the school are being chased by demons. It's up to Grace and her best friend, Wyatt, to save their school. And that's the beginning of teen horror. Then we have our book, Elvish, which I say is like kind of like Harry Potter meets Lord of the Rings. And honestly, that's kind of where my influence came from. I love Tolkien. Like, I love Tolkien. I love what you build with this universe. But the only thing that always kind of got me about Tolkien was I always ask myself is, what will happen if they still exist today? What if they have these elves and stuff and so that? What will happen? And so that's what Elvish deals with. It's elves in the modern world. It starts off with this nerdy kid, Justin, who's bullied and picked on. But then come to find out, these elves show up and tell him he's incarnation of their greatest hero. Justin wanted a better life. He's like, cool, I'll go along with this. I want to be a chosen one. But with the new reincarnation spell, come to find out he's an incarnation of their greatest villain. And now he's on the run from these elves who are trying to kill him. And he's, like, brought into this magical world with these elves and these monsters and goblins. And that's the beginning of our story, Elvish. So, pretty much, I take my influence from things that I love. When I see something that makes me passionate, makes me interested, I try to, like, create my own stories in honor of those things. So, a lot of my stories are homages. Like, Blackfist and Brown Hands are an homage to, like, Blaxploitation, Power Man and Iron Fist, a lot of the things I love. Teen Horrors are, like, a homage to, like, all those classic 80s movies with those stupid teenagers that always die. But I was like, no. I want some smart teenagers. I want someone to live. And then Elvish is a, like, again, homage to, like, Tolkien, Harry Potter, all the magic and things that will come to me. Even Avatar: The Last Airbender was a big influence for me when I crafted that book. So I try to take things I love, especially, like, things like Batman. Yeah. Like, because I know, like, again, Batman Animated Series, like, some of the writing on that show is just amazing. So, honestly, when I do my dialogue, I really try to think about, like, Paul Dini. And, again, one of my favorite writers, one of my heroes. And I try to say, like, how would Paul Dini craft this? How would he bring the emotion out in these characters? And that's, like, some of my heroes right there.
And I see that these three books have differing artwork. It's really awesome artwork, actually. The teen horror, I really like the manga look to it. And the Elvish does have that. It reminds me a lot of like the old Sega RPGs type of drawings on it.
Yeah.
Do you work with the same artist, or do you try to look for different artists when you're writing your work? Do you maybe have like a specific person that you know in mind based on their styles?
honestly, when it comes to artwork, the thing about Izzo with comic books, it's a visual medium. So the thing about Izzo is when I get ready to craft a story, I just don't look for the first artist available. I have to ask myself, what is the tone I want to set for the story? Because every artist brings their own style. For example, Black Vs. Brown Hair is drawn by this amazing artist, Lewis Calderon. Lewis has an amazing cartoony style that catches your eye and makes you laugh just looking at his pictures. So I knew I wanted to do Black Vs. Brown Hair with him. When it came time for Teen Horror, I knew I needed something crisp and realistic. So something that was going to be able to like show emotion. And that's why I went with my friend Ian, who's does like kind of like a brilliant anime meets America style. So way the characters kind of like look more lively, so you get invested in them. And then for Elvish, again, I love anime and manga. I met my good friend Wade Velasquez. Wade loves Dragon Ball Z. Yeah. And so when I knew I wanted to do like action scenes and like fights and stuff like that, I knew Wade was the perfect choice. And so I always try to choose the artist who's going to do the best job of communicating the themes and ideas of the story. And that's how I like go with that. And honestly, that's my suggestion to anybody. If you just choose an artist just to do your story, you're going to find yourself with a story that kind of falls flat with people, because the art is what creates the connection. Your words, your story ideas will always help like get the whole series across and maintain it. But the thing about it is that what's going to make that emotional investment a lot of times from the get-go is the art. The art communicates so many things without your words.
Okay, well, yeah, thank you for your time. Really awesome work here. So why don't you give us that contact info one more time?
Awesome. And thank you for interviewing me. I love the podcast. My name's Johnny Parker. You can find me at JohnnyP313 on Twitter and Instagram. And you can always just go to my website, neatocomics.com. That's NEATOcomics.com. NEATOcomics.com.
All right, man. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we have artist Jay Gonzo, creator of La Mano del Destino comic book. So, tell me about this comic book. It looks so cool. It's from the drawings alone on the cover, it's like a crime-fighting luchador?
Well, actually, it's a story of a once-champion luchador who is betrayed by his friends and unmasked in the ring, and so he makes a Faustian bargain with the mysterious promoter to gain a new name and a new power to get his revenge, but like all good Faustian bargains, he finds out quickly there's strings attached, so he's trying to extract himself from the bargain, still get his revenge, but also still remain the person he knows himself to be. And the whole comic happens in like a weird 1960s Mexico that like where like lucha libre is the most important thing in that world, but also it's like a very kind of jet age swanky Mexico that never really existed. The comic itself like looks and feels and smells like an old 60s comic because it happens in like the 60s Mexico.
And obviously lucha libre is a big inspiration, but what other things inspired you to create this story and the characters within it?
Realistically, like, I just felt that, like, kind of lucha libre had been given kind of the short shrift in American pop culture. Like, it always is kind of treated like a joke. And I also think that, like, Latino culture, when it's portrayed in American pop culture, is kind of treated like a punchline. Kind of, like, always, like, your dim-witted Mexican and stuff. And so I really wanted this to be, like, a love letter to lucha libre. I wanted it to be a love letter to, like my Latino culture. I also want, like, I wanted it to have, like, bright kind of Mexican colors and stuff. So, and then I also, like, I love Jack Kirby comics. And I wanted it to look like an old Silver Age, like, Jack Kirby comic. And I love Silver Age storytelling, and I love like those old Alex Toth, Hanna-Barbera cartoons, like like the Mighty Mitor and the Herculoids, and I love just kind of like that the bombasticness of like that kind of that 60s kind of cartoon and comic book culture. So that was a huge inspiration for me too.
Yeah, I mean the colors on this thing are amazing. It's one of the things that I've discussed with a lot of people, friends, and you know other people's online, is that nowadays superheroes and comic books all try to be—they're dour and gritty and I'm realistic, but seeing bright colors—it's something that's rarely seen now. So it's really awesome to see all these pinks and yellows and the black dark outlines, like you said, very Jack Kirby inspired. It's like really great. And apart from the comic book, is there any other things you do? I mean, I know you do. You have some T-shirts here, and these resin busts are just amazing. So apart from the comic book, are there any other projects you work on?
First of all, I want to say the resin busts were sculpted by my friend named Jason Krager. He's an amazing artist. If you can find him, it's Krager, is C-A-R-G-E, Jason Krager. He did this as a friend of mine. He has amazing sculpture work. And then secondly, I do graphic design and illustration for a living. So I do a lot of spot illustration for a lot of a lot of various clients and stuff, some of which I can and can't talk about. You know, so I do some like poster work and some like, you know, like typography and like some cool like handset type for various clients. I also tattoo here and there. Like I learned to tattoo many years ago and have been doing it since about 95. Yeah, I mean, I really put a lot of my energy into the comic and the stuff that goes around it. Sorry, taking care of business.
That's fine. He's dealing with some customers. We're live here at the expo, so we got people walking around, looking at this great artwork. And seriously, like I said, on the Facebook page, I will post all the information of websites and contact info, so you can reach out to these great artists because it is amazing work. Now, obviously, like you said, Jack Kirby comics and all that were a big inspiration. But what, as a kid, what did comic books like mean to you? Was it something that you know, for example, me, comic books, once I started reading them, it kind of like took over my life, and I said, you know what, I'm gonna become a superhero when I grow up. So I kind of want to know like what comics and animation and all that stuff kind of shaped you to how you are.
You know, when I was a kid, I think it was definitely Spider-Man that kind of brought me into comic books, and so I remember seeing like the Spider-Man cartoons and like the Spider-Man segments that were on like the Electric Company, and then the Nicholas Hammond Spider-Man movies, and I just really liked Spider-Man as a guy, but I hadn't seen comic books per se. Like the cartoon is definitely not that art style, but I grew up in Orange County, and we got the Orange County Register as a kid, and so we got the comic strips that were in there. And then the rest of my family was all in like East Los Angeles, like Pico Rivera and Montebello. And so we'd go to my grandparents' house, and they got the LA Times. And the LA Times still carried the Spider-Man daily strip, the black and white daily strip. And I just remember seeing that. And it was like, it was back when Marvel had a very house style, when that kind of Romita style of Spider-Man was real popular. And I just remember seeing that black and white brushwork Spider-Man, and like the way that like the rendering of everything that was so much... so much stylized, and it was so much more artwork than was in a regular comic strip, but also it was also reductive of the human form down to these kind of like iconic elements. And I just, for whatever reason, I just saw that kind of, I don't know who was drawing the strips at the time, and like this is probably would have been like the late 70s, but I just remember thinking like, oh man, that's cool. And I realized like
Stan Lee was writing them.
He wrote, I have the collection of, but they went through like a ton of like, you know, I think like Ross Andrew might have drawn them for a while. I think Romita may have done a few of them. Like I'm not really sure, but in my head, it's people attempting to be Romita Junior or Romita Senior. And then real early on, then my mom bought me this the old Power Records that had the Dragon Man or the Lizard Man and the werewolf story, right? And that cover was drawn by John Romita. I actually still have it framed in my house right now. And so in my head, that kind of John Romita Spider-Man was this perfect amalgamation of a character, or a perfect combination of a character I loved, drawn in a style that really resonated with me, because it was powerful but fluid, and it was like iconographic but kind of naturalistic in its form representation. And I think as an artist, I always viewed my job as an artist as like to abbreviate reality and not reflect it. Right? You were talking about how dour kind of comics have become. They've also become a little more naturalistic, a lot more agent. Like one of our big companies have this more naturalistic style where they're trying to look as real as possible, where all human form is like practical and real. And to me, like something about like Romita Sr. like kind of illustrating the, like being more of an illustrator, having a synthesis, having a point of view, and exaggerating parts but you know, de-emphasizing other parts. And then from there, jumping back and seeing like Kirby comics, I'm like, oh, as soon as I saw a Kirby comic after loving like Romita for a while, I said like, that's what I want to do. I want the idea of a hero and not an actual person in a costume, you know what I mean? And I feel that heroes work better when they're ideas and less when they're people, which is why I love luchadors, because they even obliterate their identity. They have masks on, and so they're the idea of a hero as opposed to like a fallible human being. And I think that's what really sucked me in, was just kind of like iconography, bright colors, clean lines, but tersely rendered, you know. So yeah. I guess that's a long-winded answer to your question.
No, that's a perfect answer. I see the shirts here, and you have the posters or the small prints. It says, it has a luchador mask. It says, it should be noted that a luchador does not don his mask to conceal his identity, but rather to reveal it. So I think that actually perfectly sums up what you just mentioned. Yeah. It's a great message. Is that something that you heard somebody quote, or you came up with it on your own?
I wrote that, actually, and I sometimes, every so often as an artist, as a writer, you'll do something that's just a little beyond your ability, and you look back on it and you go, oh, did I do that? Like, where did that come from?
That is totally amazing.
Thank you. So real early on, I kind of had this idea of what I wanted the world to be, that weird 1960s Mexico that really didn't exist, and so I thought at some point I should maybe explain that a little to the reader. So there's a frontispiece in each issue one that kind of explains, like, what I wanted to kind of do was like the theme song to Mystery Science Theater 3000, yeah. Where it's like, just keep in mind this is only a TV show and maybe relax a little. Because I wanted my comic to be fun. Because I worked a long time for a company where everything I did for that company I could not show to my children. It was too grim, it was too gritty. And so when I started doing my own comic, I really wanted to do something I could be proud of, something I could show my children, something it could be for every age. And so that was my La Mano del Destino came out that way. And so, but then I also realized that, like, it would have a little broader appeal, people would check it out, but I want them to understand, don't get caught up in, like, real-world physics, don't get caught up in, like, the reality of how things should be, you know, should in quotation marks. Like, just kind of let the story happen, right? And so, in the frontispiece, I start explaining, like, that this is a world that kind of looks familiar, but don't really compare it to the real world. Don't get caught up in reality too much. And then I really wanted to explain the importance to the mask, of, like, the importance of masked men in like, Mesoamerican and, like, Latino culture, and just the importance of the mask in general. And so I figured that was a good way to kind of, like, get the message across that, like, this isn't about them protecting their loved ones. Like, luchadores aren't, like, you know, Batman wears a mask so that his family, you know, because his family got hurt. You know, Spider-Man wears a mask so that Aunt May doesn't get hurt, right? A lot of heroes wear masks so that they can be, you know, also to be icons, but also to kind of protect their loved ones. The luchador doesn't have an alter ego. They're just a luchador. And so they're not hiding who they really are. They're showing you who they really are. They're like, they've foregone their own ego to become a bigger idea. And I think that kind of commitment to that sacrifice that they make is an important one. And it's a nuanced difference that I wanted to let the reader know, kind of, you know, people who aren't familiar with Lucha Libre culture. And so I wrote that line, and it kind of seemed like a nice poetic way to put it. And then when I wrote the words down, I'm like, oh man, that's a cool sentiment. Yeah, yeah. So I did surprise myself.
Yeah, that'll make a really great tattoo.
No, thank you.
Now, you know, last question. Where can we find your artwork? Do you have a website or, you know, any contact information where the listeners could look for your work?
Well, if you want the comic book specifically, it's at a website called castleandkeypublications.com. And there's a link to my store. You can read. The first three issues are online. You can read them for free. But trust me, the printed issues, if you like them online, the printed issues are much, much cooler. Because
nothing beats holding a book.
You can smell my comic because it's absorption print rather than evaporative. It's on uncoated paper, so you can feel the paper. I wanted to give people an experience more than just a story. You can get the story online, but if you want the experience, buy the issues. And they're pretty cheap. They're actually, they're a little cheaper online. Because I can't do anything about the printing cost, and so that's my website. There you get shirts and stuff too. And then also, if you want to, like, look at my stuff personally beyond just the Lucha Libre comic, my personal site is jgonzodesigns.com.
Well, thank you for your time. Amazing work, everybody. That was Jay Gonzo. So once again, I'll put in all the information so you can look for his work.
Alright, everybody, thank you for listening. And remember, if you have any questions, suggestions, or thoughts on the reviewed episodes or the show in general, send them to captain_marvelous1@yahoo.com. I have been your host, Captain Marvelous, and remember, no matter where you're from, no matter who you are, todos somos Batman.